I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this last day of 2015. A chance for us to talk about all that happened in the world the past year before we enter uncharted territory. Our guest this hour is Washington Post political reporter Janelle Ross. And Janelle is here to talk about, actually, the stories are pretty dismal when you look at the big stories of 2015. She's a political reporter for the Washington Post, The Fix. She's written about race, criminal justice, poverty, unemployment, immigration, gentrification, the state of the social safety net, and politics, as well as local, state, and national policy for the Huffington Post, USA Today, The Root, The Tennessean, The News and Observer, and the Corpus Christi Caller Times. In the AP poll of the 10 biggest stories of the past year, many of them had to do with mass shootings and with terrorism-related stories. It's very alarming list when you look at their top 10 stories. It was not a very cheerful year in many ways, and we'll try to find some stories that were good news stories as we carry on with this hour. Janelle has written recently about the grand jury declining to indict two Cleveland police officers in the death of 12-year-old Tamir Rice, which happened earlier this week. And she also wrote an interesting piece about diversification of the U.S. What does it mean to have the white majority shrinking and aging? All right, the big stories of the year, and we'll welcome your phone calls. If anybody can find a special plea, if you can find a really uplifting, hopeful story from 2015, we would love to hear from you. Our phone number, though, it doesn't have to be uplifting. When you think about the past year in terms of news, what is striking to you? What has long-term ramifications? Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well. And that's at K Dunn Show. Janelle, hello. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Thank you. When you look at the stories that the AP and many other publications have listed as top 10 news stories, it was a very hard year, wasn't it?
It was. It was definitely a year full of all sorts of trying and troubling news. Definitely.
Yeah, it sure was. Let's start before we talk about ISIS and mass shootings, et cetera. You are a political reporter, so let's look at one of the stories that, of course, was big last year, and will it ever be big this year? And that's the presidential election, which is going to take place next year. There have been, before we talk about who we're going to elect, Frank Bruni, I think, wrote a column yesterday asking if President Obama is heading in a new direction, that he is in his final year. Will he be doing more executive actions? We've heard today that he may do something concerning background checks on gun purchases. Do you think we'll see a more outspoken President Obama?
Well, certainly in 2015, he seemed to signal that he was perhaps more resolute to accomplish certain things, and that he is, in fact, willing to make use of executive orders to do so. I don't think I could begin to guess, you know, precisely what he might do in 2016. But I think there's every reasonable indication that the president does have some plans for his final year in office. There are things he plans to get accomplished. And some of those things are issues that will not move through Congress. They cannot move through Congress. So that does seem to indicate that if he's determined that an executive order would be a very real possibility on a variety of topics.
Mm-hmm. You wrote an interesting piece a few days ago about the diversification in this country and the related appeal of Donald Trump, who, as you say, wants to make America great again if the U.S. simply negotiates better deals, boots 11.3 million undocumented interlopers, bars Muslim immigration of any kind, and then normalcy, order, and prosperity will be restored. What might he be missing?
Well, I think that the first and foremost, I think that this is certainly something that there's been a lot of very interesting reporting on in 2015. But I think one of the things that many people agree seems to be organizing or galvanizing much of Trump's support is a sense of economic frustration and or insecurity.
Mm-hmm.
But those are trends that have been developing country for at least the last four decades, if not a little more. And they are not in any way new. and they are not issues that will be resolved immediately if, for instance, 11.3 million undocumented immigrants were removed from the United States. For some simple reasons, if you look carefully at the jobs that many undocumented immigrants do hold, these are not high-paid positions. It would be quite difficult to imagine that their absence would immediately resolve the economic woes of people who are gripped by this kind of economic anxiety.
And yet Bernie Sanders speaks to the same economic anxiety. So why is it that people don't go to Bernie Sanders instead of Donald Trump?
It is an excellent question, and perhaps the question of 2016. Certainly Bernie Sanders supporters would say that is absolutely true, and that Bernie Sanders has a platform and a series of ideas to try to address sort of the bigger root causes of declining economic prospects of many Americans. To be fair, perhaps Donald Trump is just a better politician, or perhaps people hear in Donald Trump's ideas or in his speeches something that makes them believe that it is more likely that he can deliver. And of course, voters have choices to make. They always make choices. So it is not, certainly unique that at this particular moment in time, those choices lean towards Donald Trump. But certainly some of what Donald Trump says and some of the ways that he campaigns do strike, I think, many people who've been covering politics and watching it very closely for a long time as rather unusual, perhaps even a little unnerving.
Mm-hmm. Well, there is a little chance that Bernie Sanders could be the Democratic nominee. It looks like it will be Hillary Clinton. Let's talk about what she takes and what she discards from 8 years of an Obama presidency that will work for her on the campaign trail. Does she associate herself as being close to him, Janelle, or not?
I think the way that you framed your question is an interesting one. It is true that there are areas where it seems that candidate Clinton is very eager to associate herself closely with the Obama administration, and areas where she's eager to distance herself. If you put that in historical perspective, that's pretty much the way that every attempted incumbent from the same party, rather, tries to run for higher office. That is the way that it's done. You're going to have to, in some ways, differentiate yourself, and in other ways, try to embrace and associate yourself with the things that that previous candidate supporters believe in strongly. It's you hope, of course, that these are the things that the candidate genuinely believes and supports, but it's also, as a practical matter, one way to begin to build a coalition of voters. You collect the people that supported your predecessor or who you hope will be your predecessor, and then you begin to build on that by also taking some different positions. And I guess to try to be a little more specific, certainly I think that we've heard from Hillary Clinton recently, in the most recent debate, for instance, some of the ways in which she feels that, security threats that are faced by the United States, and in particular ISIS, need to be dealt with, that are not completely in line with what President Obama has described, but in some ways they are similar. She has certainly been an advocate of things such as raising the minimum wage, which the president has sort of identified as among his own priorities. But she also has her own way of explaining why that is essential. I think you hear a lot more from Hillary Clinton about, for instance, the fact that many minimum wage earners are, in fact, women. And so this is something that will go a long way to help to boost the economic standing of households that are headed by single mothers and other families where women's income, and that's most American families, where women's income matters a great deal.
It sure does. Let's talk about, we're all going to be making some predictions, some of them hopeful predictions, I'm sure, tonight and tomorrow for the new year. Who do you think, let me ask this in a two-part way, who do you think will be, if you don't mind answering or making a prediction, who the Democratic nominee, the Republican nominee would be, and who would it behoove the Democrats and the Republicans to nominate, if that might be a different answer?
Well, I'm nervous about making any predictions about who the nominee might be. I'm nervous for a few reasons. I think that this year has been certainly, as I mentioned, I think something that even very, very experienced reporters who have covered many, many presidential elections, there have been some twists and turns and some developments that no one fully anticipated. And certainly, I think that many reporters are still struggling to try to fully understand.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, I think it's really hard to say with, you know, clarity and certainty, this is what's going to happen. I do think that there are some strong indicators, certainly, that Donald Trump has a very, very meaningful level of support. There are also some strong indicators that that support might not be of the type that holds up and carries him through the primary season. And by that, I just mean that many Trump supporters do not rank among the Republican Party's most reliable voters.
I see.
And there are some really interesting reporting, for instance, just today in the New York Times, about how much of Trump's appeal and how much of his groundwork will really have to focus on trying to get a certain type of conservative Democrat actually out to the polls to vote for him.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that is complicated political work. That is some serious jujitsu. It is not impossible, but it will be difficult. And that does raise the very distinct possibility that someone else who has a more traditional coalition of Republican voters who are also reliable voters that come out, who turn up, who have caucused before in Iowa, could theoretically sort of slide in and win by virtue of sort of practical political gamesmanship, I suppose, no matter what the polls tell us. And that is a real possibility. I think in Iowa, a lot of people are beginning to speculate that that could very well be Ted Cruz.
Mm-hmm.
He is leading Donald Trump in the polls right now. He has a very strong showing with evangelicals. Evangelicals are generally a pretty group of voters, certainly experienced, regular, and certainly people who caucus. So that's worth watching because that can also really shape what begins to happen in other early primary states.
Right.
So that is a long way of saying that I'm not going to offer you a firm prediction, but there are some real cues that there may be some surprises coming in 2016.
On the Democratic side,
and on the
no
Democratic
surprises.
side, I wouldn't expect as much in the way of surprises. They are, of course, always possible. Bernie Sanders, like Donald Trump, has some very, very energized supporters and some people who are very serious about wanting some sort of alternative to Hillary Clinton, or who are very interested in his program and his platform focused around reducing economic inequality. That said, in all practical ways that can be assessed objectively right now, who has the most money, who has the most voter support, who has the biggest and most extensive operation campaign-wise, who has the resources to get out the vote in these early states, it would seem to lean, all of those things would seem to lean in Hillary Clinton's favor. There are other things that also lean in her favor as well that would seem to make it likely that she'll be the nominee. But again, you never know what might happen.
You never know. Janelle, we're going to take phone calls, and we'll do that in just one moment. We're looking at the top news stories of 2015. And, of course, we started the presidential race fairly early in 2015. It'll be in full force come February 1st. And, of course, before that with the Iowa caucuses. We have a lot of other stories to cover as well. It was a year in which the AP and other news organizations have cited terrorism related deaths and mass shootings in the United States and black deaths and encounters with police. It was a year of a great deal of violence, noteworthy violence, and we will talk about that as we continue. We're also going to welcome your phone calls, and we're looking for bits of good news from 2015. Maybe you can offer some of that. or you would like to comment on what has been designated as the top stories of 2015. Our guest this hour is Janelle Ross. She's a political reporter for the Washington Post, The Fix. And here is how you reach us, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're on Twitter as well, and that's at K Dunn Show. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And our number is 800-486-8655. We go to Claire in Madison for our first caller. Janelle, hi, Claire.
Hi, Kathleen. Happy New Year to you and your guests.
Happy New Year, Claire.
I've been reflecting, and I'm sad to say this, but I would say 2015 has been the year of hate, and it's just been terrible. I hope that 2016 is a year of hope, and with that in mind, I am a big Bernie supporter. 2008, at this time of year, before the 2008 election, Hillary versus an upstart named Barack Obama. Hillary was at this same level in the polls, and Barack Obama was roughly at the level that Bernie Sanders is right now. And anything's possible. I hope that we can, and don't get me wrong, I'd love to see a woman president, but I think Bernie Sanders has some true answers that will solve some of the world's problems. And I think he's a wonderful man. He has convictions that he has shown for 40 years or more. And I hope that we can go forward and not have all this rhetoric of hate and divisiveness in 2016.
Thanks, Claire, very much for the call. She does remember a time when, and that was a very interesting election, when Barack Obama just took Iowa by storm. There he was. It was amazing.
It is true. It is true. And hence, I was afraid to give you any sort of firm prediction about 2016. It's true.
Right.
And maybe that is, in some ways, the good news that we can take out of 2015, which is this is America. Voters do have an important role to play, and they can shape this country in any way that they would like to. There can be things that happen that we cannot predict. And it really matters a great deal what individual people choose to do and, you know, the conviction with which they do it. So we shall see.
What did you think of Claire's comment, Janelle? She described it as a year of hate. In the political realm, do you see a lot of hateful speech on the campaign trail?
I am sad to say that I have to agree with Claire. It has been a year filled with all kinds of vitriol, all kinds of bigotry that has been put on display in open, unashamed ways. It is certainly interesting moment in American history, but it is also, I think, for people who would like to believe that these things are not so much a part of the American present, it's probably been deeply disheartening and eye-opening. There is just no way to deny that. When you mentioned the AP's top stories for 2015, fortunately, using the magic of Google, was able to find that story really quickly. And the list is astounding.
Isn't it?
How much of this list consists of violence.
Yes.
Violence motivated by hatred and or some sort of effort to sort of create or wrestle group control. It's truly, truly, truly disturbing.
Yes, it is. Claire, thanks very much for the call. Tom and Karen send an email with what they see as an uplifting story, and they say it's the Pope's visit to the United States. He took the country by storm, didn't he?
He did. It's true. It's definitely true. I actually had the odd experience of walking to work on a morning, you know, weekday morning in downtown D.C., and the Pope mobile went past me. And I can tell you that people on every corner just sort of froze in place. There were a lot of very happy people in that moment. It was certainly something to behold.
So what was that? Why were people so drawn to him?
You know, I think that there are people who have written some really interesting things about Pope Francis that are worth reading, that I certainly don't profess to be an expert on the church or Francis the individual. But I think that at minimum, one of the things that Francis has done, or Pope Francis has done, is begin to, speak to a more inclusive church, and a church that is, really, he often speaks about a message that is far more about how and when and what ways we can embrace people and meet people in a center. And I think that appeals to a lot of people, non-Catholics included.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, frankly, it may be particularly appealing in 2015 for the reasons that we've previously discussed.
Absolutely.
He's an interesting person with a truly a background as a real focus on pastoral care.
Yes.
And that's where he has put his energy. And perhaps that is just what people are responding to.
I love the story and the picture of him. He takes off the Pope garb and dresses as a priest and leaves the Vatican late at night to feed the homeless. I just thought that says a lot, doesn't it?
It does. I read something similar, and I was pretty delighted by that piece of information myself. Yeah, it is pretty interesting. Yeah. Even his Pope mobile is somewhat humble. It's a little cute little black Fiat. So he is certainly an interesting world figure, someone to read about and watch closely.
Robert in Manitowoc. Hi, Robert. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. I'm pleased that you gave me a chance to speak. I did think of one positive thing that happened in this year. It's coming to a close, and that is the nuclear treaty with Iran. I think it's going to be a good thing, and it will keep Iran, I hope, from developing nuclear weapons and maybe set the stage for friendlier relations between ourselves and Iran. And the other thing I wanted to say is more of a question. Bernie Sanders got in trouble with the Democratic Democratic National Committee in terms of one of his workers was getting some information out of their files about potential candidates for Hillary Clinton, and I guess that was a no-no, and they kind of closed it down for him completely, and he did fire the guy that was responsible for the misdeed, and then apparently he still was kind of closed off from information that the Democratic National Committee had, and he was bringing lawsuit, and that's the last I heard. I hope you can bring me up to date on that. I kind of support Bernie, and I would like to see him run. I'm sure I would undoubtedly vote for the Democratic nominee, but Bernie kind of appeals to me, and I hate to see him closed out. Hope you'll comment on that.
Thank you, Robert. Janelle, is there still a lawsuit?
You know, that is an excellent question, and I'm going to be honest because I think it's best when you don't know the answer. I don't know the answer.
I don't either.
Of that suit, but I'll see what I can find out and hopefully try to answer that question.
Okay.
But I don't know the answer right off the top of my head. I definitely would agree that the sort of recent tangle between the Sanders campaign and the DNC really sort of points to a number of issues. Some of them are the sort of things that usually sort of hide beneath the known surface for the average voter. It's a little too inside baseball. There are some tensions inside the DNC, and I think that people are aware that there are many people who feel that the DNC has done everything possible to really sort of create a clear and easy path for Hillary Clinton to the nomination, including and not limited to the way that the debates are structured and when they are scheduled to take place. So that is certainly part of the backdrop to, the tensions that sort of boiled over and went public this month. But I'll see what I can find out and try to answer that.
So what do you think, Janelle, the reason would be for having all these Democratic debates on Saturday night? I don't get it.
This is one of these, I think that everyone has much the same response. Certainly anyone who has to cover the debate wonders, I'm sure, like I do, about the Saturday scheduling. And I think that what you've heard from the DNC is a number of answers that are not particularly strong, but they include that this is the time that they were able to secure from the network, that there are a number of considerations and a number of schedules that have to be coordinated, so these are the dates that could be made to work. Given the importance of the debates,
It is true, of course, that networks have their own sort of financial goals, but frankly, given the kind of ratings that the Republican debates have brought in, it's sort of hard to believe that it wouldn't be possible at this point if the DNC were interested to get at least some debate scheduled at a time when that might not strike so many people as sort of outside of the main TV watching hours. That said, you know, that is the explanation that has been offered. And the year is young again, or 2016 is yet to begin. But once it does, it will be quite young. And so this is perhaps something that could shift. But that is where things stand.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Robert, so much for your call. Ray in Milwaukee is next. Hi, Ray.
Hi, and Happy New Year's to everybody.
Happy New Year.
This is the year of the drones, both here in America and especially the Shepherd Express ran the most undercovered stories of the year. And they had this number from American drone strikes in just Pakistan. 80% of the people we've killed there have been innocent people. So it's over 1,500 people. And then here in our country, the drones have been flying near airplanes, and how long will it be before we have some terrible mishap here from toys? So the year of the drone. This is definitely the year of the drone. Okay.
Okay, Ray. Thanks for the call. Janelle.
That is an interesting assessment. It, too, was not a cheery one, certainly, for 2015. And there is certainly some real and important information that is available about the way that drones are being used and who is, in fact, being affected by them. I think, of course, there are people who would immediately argue that you also have to be mindful of what our options or alternatives might be. If we moved away from drone warfare, would that necessarily require more, as is often said, boots on the ground? And is that something that the American public is willing to support? Or is force truly the answer here at all, of course? So I cannot, begin to offer any sort of encouraging news, I suppose, on the drone front, what can be said. But it is true that, we certainly have invested in and really ramped up our activities with drones. That's true.
Thanks, Ray. Sarah in Lake Zurich, Illinois. Happy New Year, Sarah.
Happy New Year. Thank you. I'm not sure how optimistic this is or good news, but I'm very interested in what's happening in Chicago with, I feel optimistic about it, with the protests against the police, against police violence, and the information that's come out that the government of Chicago had just concealed for so long. And so these protesters just seem to me to be really organized and have a really clear sense of purpose, and I don't think they're going to go away, and I feel like something is going to develop out of this, and I don't know what exactly, but and it seems like there's a bunch of white people who are joining protests, and boy, would I love to see that mayor resign, but I don't know what's going to happen, but I like this all coming to the surface and people really seeing what's happening in Chicago.
Thank you, Sarah. Janelle.
I think that Sarah makes a really excellent point, and it's probably the way that we all, if we find ourselves, in need of some sort of uplift at this point in the year, it probably is a way for us all to be thoughtful about the things that are in the news. There is something to be said for the fact that the amount of information that we now have or that has come to the surface this year with regard to race and policing is in and of itself, while disturbing, the increasing transparency is itself an improvement. My father is a criminal lawyer in the state of Texas, and I was just having a conversation with him last night. I'm visiting the family. And, he said to me, these are things that have been going on in this country for years and years. The difference now is that many more people are aware. And oftentimes to deal with the most difficult things in our own lives, I think people know that you have to first face exactly the extent of the mess. You've got to acknowledge it. And perhaps that's the phase that we're in.
I also would agree with Sarah that certainly there's, you know, evidence that public information laws and the judicial process certainly worked in such a way in Chicago that information that it seems there was a real effort to suppress has been made public. It has come to light, and it has got to be discussed and dealt with. So as disturbing as the truth may be, perhaps that is the bright light here as well. At least now we know.
Do you think the mayor will lose his job over this in Chicago, Janelle?
I wouldn't even begin to hazard a prediction. I think that is a very real possibility. But I also think that this is Rahm Emanuel that we're talking about, who is, I think, inside of the political world, many people consider him a genius and a person capable of political maneuvers never before seen or, you know, rarely executed. So I would not also say with any certainty that it's definitely over for him, but he definitely is in a precarious position.
Mm-hmm.
There certainly are people who would very much like to see him pushed out or step down from office, and that is a possibility. But it is also possible that Rahm Emanuel could rise from the ashes. So I would hazard a prediction there.
You wrote a piece this Monday on the grand jury declining to indict two Cleveland police officers in the death of 12-year-old Tamir Rice and asked, would he have been alive if he'd been a 12-year-old white boy playing with a toy gun?
You know, I think that that is a question that many people have. There have been, in Ohio, some similar incidents, and certainly around the country, in the time since Tamir Rice's death, where people with actual weapons or people with toy weapons who have survived an encounter with police. And there are all sorts of questions that sort of lie within that contradiction that probably need to be examined closely. I am not, of course, the person who can answer them all, but it is certainly true. In addition to that, I think that what perhaps is worthy of some very careful thought and attention is that what you do have, no matter what you think about what happened in that park and what information was shared with those officers, what was not, and what assumptions were made and what were not, is you do have a 12-year-old boy who is dead. And at present, it appears that there will be no legal consequences for anyone. That is a very, very serious thing. It is a deeply unnerving thing, I would think, to many parents in Cleveland, particularly parents of boys who look anything like Tamir Rice.
Mm-hmm.
It is, you know, not something that people probably are prepared, and I'm unsure that they should be prepared to simply sort of put that on the, well, that's over, and sort of brush it off and keep moving list. It is a very serious and very great thing, and it is a deeply frightening thing that really demands some sort of resolution. You know, to his credit, Governor Kasich did say later in the week that the state of Ohio was engaged in a process of trying to really assess, I guess, the training, but also the information that is shared between dispatcher and police officer in the belief that had perhaps a more full accounting of the 911 call that sent the police to the park, had it been transmitted to that police officer, which included that this might not have been a real gun, that the outcome might have been different.
Right.
And, you know, at least some effort to take care and look at the situation closely and say what could be done to prevent this from happening again seems to be at least a minimal necessity at this point.
I believe you reminded us of this, and the number is probably higher now. There were over 975 police shootings around the country in 2015. 42.9% of those shootings left a black or a Latino person dead.
That's certainly true. And just to put that in perspective, Latinos make up 17% of the U.S. population. African Americans make up 13% of the American population. Together, that's about 30%. That is, you know, by nature, it indicates that people of color are being killed at an elevated rate or a disproportionate rate. In addition to that, and I think this is one of the sort of often unspoken issues here, is that police in the United States do in fact shoot and kill more people than are shot and killed by law enforcement agencies in most developed countries. So at minimum, we know that people are experiencing really, both police officers and individuals who come in contact with police in the United States are at an elevated risk of a serious injury or death. That doesn't always mean that there was something nefarious or illegal that happened or that the officer even had other choices, but it does certainly sort of merit a deeper and closer examination. You know, those numbers are raw
yes.
and cold, but we are talking about individual human beings who have families and people who love them and care about them
right.
who are gone.
Yeah. All right. Writer writes on Facebook, I agree that this past year has been a year of hate, and as a result, the only uplifting stories I can think of are dog rescue stories. I love that any dog story is okay with me, as this audience knows. Dogs and Abraham Lincoln can't be beat. But he says that, and this is a wonderful thing we're seeing on Facebook, Aretha Franklin show going around the internet right now of Aretha performing at the Kennedy Center to honor Carole King, and her singing brought a tear to President Obama, who was in attendance. She played a wicked piano, and that lady can still really sing, can't she? It's great.
It's true. It is certainly true. And I wouldn't at all quibble with these two stories. Certainly the other day I saw something on Twitter that made me laugh probably far too long, but I saw something that someone had tweeted out about if dogs wore pants, how would they wear them?
Yes,
they wear them over all four legs or over two. And it made me laugh, like really out loud, which again probably speaks to either exactly how grim it has been in 2015 or really how funny that is.
Or both, right?
Yeah, and I actually caught just a little bit of Aretha Franklin's performance myself, and it was remarkable. So,
it was.
I would agree with both of those ideas.
Yeah, thank you, writer. Thank you. We'll take more phone calls in a moment. We're talking about the big news stories of 2015. When you look at the AP list and other organizations that compile such lists, you find that the news is pretty grim from 2015. So we're asking for you to not only respond to the grim news, but if you saw something that was particularly uplifting, and we've had a response from you, we would like to hear that as well. Here's how you reach us, 800-486-8655. And our email is talk@WPR.org, Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show, Twitter, @KDunnShow. Our guest is Janelle Ross. Janelle is a political reporter for The Washington Post, The Fix, and she writes about everything. We'll take more phone calls in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Next caller is Mark in Richland Center. Happy New Year, Mark. Hi.
Happy New Year. The good news is that not in our country, but in Iceland, they've already arrested 26 bankers for crashing their economy. Our economy was crashed by our bankers, not by our people. And in Iceland, they've arrested 26 bankers. They've also given them 74 years worth of prison time. They have in consideration at their parliament a law that would take away the ability for banks to create money. That same law is also being considered in Switzerland. And the question that really needs to be asked by the press and by the people is, if money is something that we invented as an idea to help us interact with each other, then why are we loaning money into existence instead of creating it directly from our governments that have the sovereign power to create money? So that's what the bill is going to do if it passes in Switzerland and it passes in Iceland. And it's been considered in Greece. It's been considered in lots of places. There was a bill called 2990 introduced in our legislature by Dennis Kucinich. The question is, are we going to see it in our news that money itself is an idea first? We invented it, so how could we ever have not enough of it? And since it's not making the news here, at least it is happening in places where they do get it, and they've even arrested bankers in Iceland for doing what they've done.
Thank you, Mark, for the call. Janelle,
That's a lot of interesting. Those are
yes.
interesting ideas. There are a whole list of things that we technically invented that certainly drive and control us and shape our lives and sometimes make them hard. Time would be one of them. So, you know, it is, it's an interesting, certainly, set of ideas. You know, to his larger point about, I guess, penalties for those who, you know, profited directly or benefited from, I think, some of the tremendous economic turmoil around the world and certainly in this country. It is true that the number of people who have ultimately been arrested in this country for anything related at all to the causes of the Great Recession is quite limited. I was just thinking of a story that I read, I want to say in mid-2014, that at the time there really had been only one person who had been sent to jail for activities here in the United States related to the causes of the Great Recession. What has happened is there's been, I think, a lot of information thrown at people about some of the financial machinations and, as they say, financial products and innovations that were developed. I think most people know what a subprime mortgage and is, and certainly the idea that these were being packaged and sold in groups and tranches. I think most people have heard that language at this point. Unfortunately, I'm not sure that the number of Americans who have the sort of clarity that Mark feels that he has about the root causes of the Great Recession, I'm not sure that that is a figure that is as high as it should be either. And I think this is an odd situation where a lot of detailed information has not necessarily helped to, I think, give the general American public a really clear picture of what caused the recession, and therefore this is where we really need to focus our attention. And this is where, I suppose, if blame is going to be parceled right. out, it should be parceled. We've really seen something else entirely.
It affected so many people, didn't it, Janelle? So many people.
Certainly. I guess I sometimes have different ways of viewing this data, but there's certainly a lot of data that suggests that many Americans do not, at this point, believe the recession to be over.
Mm-hmm.
You know, technically, the Great Recession began in 2007 and ended in 2009. There was a slow but steady recovery, and the recession has, at this point, been over for a number of years. But the fact that so many people believe it to be ongoing, you know, on the one hand, you can sort of flippantly say that perhaps they're just not paying attention, they're not aware, they're not reading, they're not aware that there is an official definition for a recession, and all of those things may be possible and true in some cases, but it is also a real indicator that there are a lot of people who continue to struggle mightily and who are experiencing a kind of economic insecurity, that they did not before the Great Recession,
right.
or perhaps it intensified in a way that they have never known. And they have yet to climb back to the place where they were beforehand. So for them, this feels like an ongoing recession. And that is, you know, certainly troubling and certainly real. And there is certainly, unfortunately, plenty of data to support that. Median incomes have only finally this year returned to where they were before the Great Recession. The amount of wealth lost by Black and Latino households in the Great Recession has not been recovered. It was basically everything that had been gained in the preceding 30 years. So it was truly a monumental economic event that has also changed many people's lives.
It certainly has. And Mark, on another note, we should do a show on Iceland because they had a big economic crisis some years ago. And what you said was interesting. The other interesting story, when we haven't yet talked about refugees, but remember the story about Iceland that nobody was taking in Syrian refugees, and the people in Iceland on Facebook said, we're opening our homes, we have rooms for you, and they made room for some 10,000 people just out of the goodness of their hearts. So something's going on that may be okay in Iceland, so we'll look at Iceland. We have yet to talk about, before we go back to phone calls, Janelle, we certainly need to talk about terrorism and the Islamic State and what's being done to fight it and the kinds of potential problems that could create for presidential candidates or make some candidates stronger than others. It really took over the news the last few months. And if there are other incidents, and just fighting ISIS is another big expenditure with different ideas on how to do that, it's going to play out somehow in 2016, I would imagine.
That's certainly true, both in terms of the discussion and actual decisions that will have to be made by existing elected officials, and certainly it will play a major role. It seems very clear in the 2016 presidential election. I think, as you mentioned, just in the last few months, public interest, concern, focus on national security issues, and in particular the threat that is posed by ISIS, has intensified tremendously. But you've also seen that reflected in which candidates seem to be rising and which candidates seem to be on the wane. And of course, as I've said many times over the course of this hour, you know, there are many things that are yet to happen between now and Election Day, and that might change. But it certainly does raise also an interesting set of questions for an electorate that has, at least thus far, said that we are looking for, or we are most interested in, or we are most excited by, candidates that do not have experience governing, that do not have experience on diplomatic missions or, I guess, international negotiations involving government. And it does raise a real question about the value of experience and whether or not that is something that voters are truly willing to completely diminish or toss aside. I heard someone say the other day, this has been the year of the anti-resume in politics. And I think that the question is, what are the things that really voters are going to determine or decide that they feel are essential? What are the bullet points that must exist on someone's resume? And what is it that they're willing to take some chance or show some faith that this person has these skills so they can develop these other skills? You know, that will be one of the big questions of 2016.
One more phone call. We're running short on time. Nate in Milwaukee. Hello. Happy New Year.
Hi.
Hi.
Happy New Year. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
I was going to mention, now there are a lot of important issues going on even right this moment, but one sort of sleeper issue your guest may not heard of is the John Doe investigation here in Wisconsin potentially going to the Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. The situation, as far as I can see it, and there's a number of aspects, interesting aspects to it, is that there was campaign coordination between a third-party organization and state-level campaigns here in Wisconsin, and that had been banned for a long time. And the state Supreme Court overturned that case and ordered the evidence destroyed, supposedly because of federal law. But federal law actually says that it is the, quote, absence of prearrangement and coordination that allows you to feel that third-party organizations are contributing to speech and not engaging in improper relationships with political candidates. So in this Supreme Court, where you do have a leaning towards increasing the amount of money in politics, you also, my understanding, is have an ethical understanding as to what's proper for judges. And the state Supreme Court judges that overturned the investigation themselves took several million dollars in campaign contributions.
Mm-hmm. And on that note, Nate, I'm going to have to say goodbye to you, but it is a case to watch during 2016, certainly, and I'm glad we had a chance to get you on. Janelle, thank you very much for being with us. I hope you'll join us again. It was enlightening and fun. You don't get better than that, right?
Yes, definitely. I really appreciate you having me and hope you and your listeners have a happy new year.
Thanks, Janelle. You too. Janelle Ross, political reporter for the Washington Post, The Fix. She writes about race and criminal justice and poverty, unemployment, immigration, gentrification, the presidential campaign, etc. Thanks very much to Scotty Myers for producing this hour, and thanks to Scotty as well for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. El Nino, next hour of the program, what it's doing to our weather. It's incredible, isn't it? So all of that's coming up momentarily. Stay with us.